Hi, I'm Reverend Carol Saunders, host of the Spiritual Forum. I'm here with a lot of interesting people who are consciously walking the spiritual path, experiencing and expressing the divine in unique ways and through unique lenses. Everyone here has wisdom to share and an interesting story to tell, all to inspire you on your spiritual path. Welcome to the Forum. Welcome, everyone, to the Spiritual Forum. I'm so glad you're here. I just want to say how much I appreciate all of my listeners and subscribers, and we are all on this path together, the spiritual path. This podcast is a voice of hope, inspiration, and awakening in the world. And so anybody who has interest in hope, inspiration, awakening, I know that my guest today will really inspire you and awaken you and hopefully help you along with your journey. Let me introduce her. Her name is Kyra Jewel Lingo. She's a Dharma teacher whose work continues the engaged Buddhism developed by Thich Nhat Hanh. And after living as an ordained nun for 15 years in Thich Nhat Hanh's monastic community, she now teaches internationally in the Zen lineage, the Vipassana tradition, and a focus on activists, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, artists, educators, families, and youth. She's the author of We Were Made for These Times and co-author of Healing Our Way Home, Black Buddhist Teachings on Ancestors' Joy and Liberation. That's just a small snapshot of Kyra. I'm going to let her fill in the blanks of her very interesting life. Would you just share a little bit about your fascinating story? I think it's so unique, and it's just something I know that we'll all really learn from.
Sure. So my parents decided to join a family religious order that was doing village development, human development work all over the world, but it started on the west side of Chicago, where my mom is from, and my dad's from Texas, so they formed an interracial relationship, white father, black mother, and we're living in this very non-mainstream community where everyone kind of was living as a monastic, even though it was lay people with families. So people, you know, held all things in common. We had cars that we would all use together and lived on donations very simply with just a stipend every month. And it was in an international community. So I spent 4 years living in Kenya as a young child, and then just grew up, you know, waking up at 5 every morning and going down for daily office, this morning service every morning in the dark with incense and singing and chanting and scripture, and being raised around, you know, about 100 other kids that were cared for communally. Well, we had one night a week for family night dinner where we could eat with our parents. All the other meals were with the other children. But we had camp in the summers and a lot of exposure to other cultures. And, you know, my best friend was Indian. Another best friend in the community was from the U.S. And there were African children and Asian children. We were all living together and growing up together. So, yeah, we left when I was 14. We moved to Atlanta. I went to high school in Atlanta, did a summer in Mexico, year abroad in Brazil with a family my junior year, and learned Portuguese, learned some Spanish, went to college, really felt drawn to deepen my spiritual path at the end of my time in college. And so I found my way to Plum Village in southwest France, established by a Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese monk nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Dr. King. And lived for 15 years in that community as a nun and traveled all over the world, shared mindfulness with children, with teachers, families, youth. We started our first people of color retreats 20 years ago now. And I was part of working on climate change as a nun. So a lot of activism as well as contemplative practice and a lot of engagement, sharing mindfulness with people all over the world, and then decided to leave after 15 years and made this kind of awkward transition back into lay life. I wrote about that in my first book, We Were Made for These Times, how what helped me in that those moments of major transition, and have, you know, got married to my, you said you're an interfaith minister. My husband is an Episcopal priest. So we combine Buddhism and Christianity in our home every day, and we teach it now as well. We just received a gift of a monastery, actually. So we're going to have a physical center where we will be building a Buddhist Christian community and a hermitage, a place of practice, a place of contemplation and action together, where the spiritual but not religious can also find a home of any faith or none. And so, yeah, my days are spent teaching and mentoring and practicing, yeah, in this new form on Long Island.
So your father, was he, can you share what the religious upbringing that you had?
Sure. So my dad is a Christian minister in the Disciples of Christ. You know, he was ordained in that tradition, although he worked and lived ecumenically. This community I described was an ecumenical community. It was called the Ecumenical Institute, or the Order Ecumenical, and then it, in the 80s, it began to be called the Institute of Cultural Affairs. So, and my mom was a very practicing Christian. They all the adults studied and did a lot of deep engagement with theologians like Bonhoeffer and Niebuhr and Teilhard de Chardin. So there was a lot of study, and they really, the people who came together to create this community, their intention was to renew the church, to really help everyone, lay and ordained. You could say, like, maybe you could call it engaged Christianity for Protestant families and communities. So what they would do is they would go into any community. So they, at a certain point in the community's history, there was a village development project or a human development project everywhere in every time zone of the world. So they would go into a community, whether it was a rural community in, you know, the Egyptian desert or Latin America or Asia, or maybe it was on a Native American reservation or an inner city, or, you know, Isle of Dogs in off the coast of, you know, United Kingdom. And they would have a meeting, and they would gather everyone. Even, like, I remember in Egypt, at first, men did not want women to be there at this meeting, and they insisted women have to be there. So they would sit at the back, the men would sit at the front, the women sit. Anyway, they would gather all the stakeholders and lead them through a kind of strategic planning workshop to get them to articulate what they felt was the most important thing for their community, and then come up with a plan of action, whether it was we need a bridge, or we need a school, or we need a women's cooperative, or we need an irrigation system. The whole community would decide on it, and then that would become the village development project or the human development project. So on the west side of Chicago, in this, you know, Black inner city area or working class area, they've had a preschool, you know, and they had a legal clinic. So it was what that community determined was needed, and they helped build it. And our community helped provide resources. Sometimes, like, I remember when we lived in Kenya, there would be groups of dentists and nurses and doctors who would volunteer. And we had 500 village projects in Kenya alone. So our hub was, wow, Nairobi. So they would take these dentists and nurses and doctors around, and they would just do an outdoor clinic and pull people's teeth and fill fillings and with all their equipment. So that was one of the things we could do, our community could do, was bring in support. But, you know, as far as building the buildings, people from that community did that. They brought their own know-how, their own resources, and it had to be self-sustaining. So it wasn't like, you know, all these projects were constantly funded, you know, through us, but it was really like, we'll get it started, help you figure out what you want to do, do it, and then it has to keep going from within your community. So that was really the work. My dad did a lot of fundraising around East Africa for these village development projects.
Yeah, so your whole upbringing was very, very community-oriented, very, very service-oriented. Mm. You were immersed in that growing up. So it's really no surprise that you've kind of dedicated your life to being in service to people. I think the whole commune kind of living in Chicago, I think that was so interesting because you just don't expect to have that kind of living arrangement, community arrangement in the city. You know, it sounds like something that would be out in some remote area somewhere. And I lived in Chicago for 10 years and it kind of surprises me because it's like the juxtaposition of that with all of the urban stuff that's going on. It just seems like it would really be in, I wouldn't call it in conflict, but just kind of an interesting place to have that kind of living in the midst of all of the rest of this very normal, I shouldn't say normal, very, very culturally normal, I guess. I don't know. What would you call it?
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely...
Whatever the rest of
society
is.
We were definitely going against the stream. It was going against the stream. It was, you know, countercultural, you could say, or definitely non-mainstream. But so when I grew up in this community, the community had moved from the west side to the north side. So we grew up near the lake, near Sheridan and Lawrence. I don't know if that means anything to you, but it was in an old 8-story insurance building that was basically given to the community. So the offices were turned into some small bedrooms, and we had this ancient elevator that was, you know, hand operated with a lever, and we would live in that building. So there was one floor for the dining area. There was one floor for the children's, you know, care. There were the residential floors. There were the meeting floors. And that's how I grew up, was walking up those flights of stairs using those elevators and being right in the city, right near the lake, going to public school, you know, kindergarten, first, second grade. And one of the things that one of the women who took care of us children told me when I was grown up, she said, the teachers of all you kids would always know who in their class was from this community because those kids could just read the group and could tell the teacher what was going on, like could help the teacher understand the needs of the class because they were so used to living in community and knowing what was going on with a group that the teacher could always tell who in her class was from this community.
That's so interesting. It makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm really kind of intrigued by what caused you to go to Plum Village and to pursue that avenue for your life.
Yeah. So, you know, we left the community when I was 14. The community started to kind of, it wasn't financially viable anymore, is what I understand. And so it disbanded the residential aspect. It still continues as a nonprofit doing strategic planning, still in that building in Chicago, but just on a couple floors. So many people left. And so we went to Atlanta, and my dad had been in the civil rights movement and wanted to be back close to, you know, friends he had worked with in the 60s, like the Honorable Andrew Young. And so we moved there, and I remember, so it was my first time, I was born into this community. So at 14, it was my first time not living in this community. And just me and my dad, and my parents had divorced at that time, so it was me and my dad and his fiance. And it was just three of us, and I felt, even then, I remember coming home one day at age 15 or something and thinking, there's got to be more than just this, like this nuclear family, everyone kind of hustling, trying to make it, a focus on, you know, economic security. I just really felt this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. At 15, I was kind of like, no, this is... I was having culture shock, maybe, you know, leaving that community and adjusting. But I already knew, I was like, there's got to, I knew my life had to have more of a spiritual grounding than what I was experiencing in mainstream society. And so in college, we went to church, me and my dad would go to a religious science church and his fiance. And then in college, I continued to go, you know, to church. I really liked spiritual practice. That's how I had grown up. That's what I knew. And I got a wonderful education. I did a bachelor's, master's. And then at the end of that, I was thinking of going on to do a PhD, but I remember Ram Dass came to our college and said, you know, you learn a lot here, but you don't learn how to be happy. And that really stuck in my heart. I was like, I want to learn how to be happy. So a friend of mine told me about Plum Village, and I decided to go after I graduated, and I went for the summer. This was in 97. They have a month-long summer retreat, and I was really looking for a teacher. I knew I need to find a teacher. I need to find a community. And as soon as I saw Thay, we call Thich Nhat Hanh, Thay means teacher in Vietnamese, I knew this is my teacher. And I really saw the community practicing what Thay taught. And I thought, okay, this is it. And so I canceled the rest of my trip around Europe, and I just stayed another 4 months. And after that, I thought, well, why don't I just do this all the time? Because I found myself really learning how to be happy, all the things I really wanted to learn. At the end of my education, I was like, yeah, I can really learn everything here. So I, at the end of that time, 4 months, I was like, why don't I ordain? And so I, you know, about 2 years later, I did become a nun.
That's a big commitment. That's a really big commitment. Mm. But it sounds like a couple of things I want to reflect on. First of all, it seems like a fairly common theme with some of my guests, where they just very early age knew that the rat race, the hamster wheel, the seeking material satisfaction and accomplishment was not for them, and something else was so much bigger. And I just find it really fascinating that there's something in your soul, your spirit from the very beginning that knew it had a purpose here, and then you were drawn to Plum Village and then stayed there. I'm very curious about what it was like there. And can you share a little bit about what Thich Nhat Hanh is like? Because so many listeners I know have read his books but haven't gotten close to him like you have. So it'd be really interesting to know what your experience was.
Well, you know, he was his presence was so permeating. Like when you were around him, it was like you couldn't just rush around or be mindless, because something in his bearing had an effect on you, and you were kind of called into yourself, into your body, maybe there was an element of, you know, there was such deep respect for him that I think there was this like, Thay's coming, you know, of this sense of let me really be mindful when he passes by if we're, you know, in the same area. But also, he was so relaxed and at ease and free, even as he was so deeply present. It was like this amazing combination of incredible gentleness and like force and power that I had never encountered in anyone like that before. Just such an incredible energetic presence. And you'd all come sit in the hall for the talk. He would come in, and it would be like this calm settled over everyone, just because his presence was so still, was so at ease. Yeah. And he had a lovely smile, and when he would laugh, it would be so fun to laugh with him. He had a lightness, even as he was this, you know, incredible scholar and could share such deep teachings and be so, you know, just so such an incredible mind to grasp, you know, so many things that were happening in the world and relate them to things that had happened historically. And he was also a real bridge builder. So he brought, you know, Western and Eastern culture together. He brought Christianity and Buddhism together. He really tried to renew Buddhism, the Buddhism that he had inherited in Vietnam. So he was always innovating and being very supportive of women practicing and having leadership positions, and nuns having as much leadership as monks, which wasn't the case in traditional Vietnamese temples in Vietnam. he was a peacemaker. He was invited to, like, you know, speak at very prestigious world stage events like the World Economic Forum and speaking to the Congress in India and to the House of Lords in the UK and to the House of Congress in the US. And he could speak to that level of people, even doing, we did retreats for Congress people, but he would also go into prisons and give a Dharma talk about be free where you are to people in prison. He could, you know, speak to, you know, the humblest of peasants in Vietnam. And he was he had so much space inside of him that he could relate to anybody. He could be close to anybody. He could make anyone feel close to him in that sense of, like, no ego, no you, no me. And his deepest intention and wish was to support everyone on the path of awakening, this real bodhisattva path. So he was, you know, when I think about what he was able to do energetically, especially as an older man, we would go on teaching tours with him, and he would be in his 70s and his 80s. We would travel for 2 months throughout the US or throughout Asia or throughout Europe, and he would give a talk every day. Can you imagine? And he would lead walking meditation for thousands of people through, you know, the heat of New Delhi or through, you know, cold, windy, you know, Dublin, Ireland or whatever, Paris. And he would walk like, you know, a tiger. He was just so majestic how he would lead people in this slow, profound walking meditation. But, you know, he just had this ability to stay energized. He only missed one retreat that I know of because he got a serious infection in his lungs, where we had to, all of us had to, you know, teach that retreat. No other retreat did he miss in his whole, you know, probably 60, 70 years of teaching. Anyway, so he had an extremely resourced, energetic field, but he also knew how to rest, right? When he would not do anything superfluous on a trip like that. He wouldn't chat. He wouldn't let his mind go off into, you know, just mindless thinking. He was present with everything he did, conserving his energy, knowing how to use his energy very carefully so that when he had to be on, he could be really on, you know? But, you know, I'll just tell a story of when I was attending him. So as novices, we got to be his attendant, where we would serve, you know, bring his meal when he would be coming to our hamlet to give the teaching, to lead the day of mindfulness. We would bring him his meal. We would, you know, help him throughout the day. So I was his attendant with another sister. We would always be in teams. And he just said, after lunch, he liked to lay in the hammock in his room. So we would push the hammock so he could sway back and forth. And he just looked at me and he said, you know, Chogyam was my name in Vietnamese, meaning adornment with jewel or true jewel. He said, Chogyam, other people are the path. Other people are the path. And I knew he was saying that to me because he knew that I was struggling with an older sister who was a little bit harsh in her way of speaking. Other people also had difficulties with that, but I was suffering as a newly ordained nun. And I really took that in, that teaching. He didn't say anything else. I didn't need him to say anything else. I got his message in just that one sentence, that I really needed to see this difficult relationship as my path of practice, that I could use what was coming up in me to understand my mind more deeply, to support my heart, to widen, to grow bigger, to understand that she also had suffering, and to really see that she was my path of practice, that it wasn't that I had to try to get away from her or get around her, but that going exactly through the things that are difficult are what brings us to spiritual deepening. So he always had, you know, this way somehow of knowing in a way and giving just the right teaching.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it helps us all get a little closer to him. And I doubt anyone is surprised because these really enlightened souls, they have to exude something that's so different. And you were very fortunate to be in that circle for the amount of time that you were. I'm also kind of curious as to what it was that inspired you to leave and to pursue a non-monastic life.
I really, you know, I felt called to become a monastic, and I felt called to leave monastic life as well. I share about this some in the book, Healing Our Way Home. I had a very strong call to motherhood, even though I really loved monastic life, and I had thought I would stay a nun my whole life. And I kind of had a journey of about 5 years after leaving monastic life, where I felt I was supposed to have a child, but that unfolded a little differently than I knew, than I could expect. But what I think really was the calling was to bring what I had been trained to do into the world. I think that was really the underlying piece, because the motherhood quest sort of got fulfilled in a way that I wasn't expecting, where it was some kind of, I think I had a sort of a task to fulfill with that, which was really about releasing it. That was the whole purpose of that coming into my life, was to really deeply release that and let go. And so then I was clear, I'm not here to have a biological child, but to really, you know, offer myself outside of the monastery and to maybe populations and groups that would not have as much access if I were just in the monastery. And then I met my partner, which also felt like a big part of the unfolding that I was supposed to be going through in terms of weaving a Buddhist and Christian path together and now creating a kind of center where people can come and practice.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that. But before we do that, I want to highlight what you said about your calling to go to monastery and then your calling to leave. Because I think that's really important for people who are listening to get that sometimes we have a calling and we answer that calling. If we're really in tune with the divine guidance we're getting, we answer that calling. And that doesn't mean that that's where we're going to be forever. So we should always be awake to new callings and new directions, and even ask the question, am I still supposed to be here? I've had many pivots answering the calling of spirit myself.
Yes.
And, you know, you go for a while and it seems like this is what you're going to be doing. And then, nope, I'm being called over here. And there's something about the flexibility within your soul to be able to really discern that voice and then take action and not assume that whatever that first calling was, you know, what the divine has decided for you forever, because our paths are circuitous and we have all sorts of different experiences. So you fulfilled your calling at the monastery and then were guided somewhere else. And that's what you're doing now.
I just wanted to add to what you just said, that life also comes in cycles. And I felt like I completed a cycle when I was leaving the monastery, that I needed to do that. I very much needed to do that. And the cycle was complete there. Yeah.
I so understand that. I was called to start a church. I started a church in a northern suburb of Chicago, and I led that for 10 years. And in the middle of it, I kind of completed a cycle and moved my church to another kind of expression. And then after a while, I felt complete in that cycle. And now I'm doing this podcast, Prayer and Retreat Ministry. And there is something about a sense of completion. And so many people keep staying, you know, like we're not able to discern that my time is up here and what else is there for me. So I really appreciate that you brought up the cycles of life, and we do start things and we do complete them. So now let's talk about your new cycle that you're in. And I know that you're working in the intersection of racial, climate, and social justice, and you're working with the BIPOC community and bringing the Dharma to that community, and also your Buddhist Christian retreat. So why don't we just go into that direction about what you're doing now?
Sure. So my partner and I began to offer a monthly Buddhist Christian online group. It was the Buddhist Christian Community of Meditation and Action. I've been doing that for a little over 2 years and has now, you know, blossomed into this first in-person retreat, which we just offered last weekend, which was really beautiful. There was Buddhist practices, Christian practices, and it was at a perfect location, which was the Garrison Institute, which was a Catholic seminary and is now a Buddhist retreat center. So we had, you know, a building with crosses on it and stained glass windows in the, you know, main chapel or meditation hall. And yet we were, you know, practicing walking meditation around the grounds or But Adam offered the Eucharist as part of our time together. It was a beautiful experience for people who are multiple faiths or maybe have a Christian upbringing, but are now drawn to, you know, Eastern traditions, but want to stay connected to their roots. It was also a place for people who were neither Buddhist nor Christian. There was a Jewish person there. There were people who grew up Hindu and Sikh who came. So this whole, you know, as I understand it, the majority of young people in the United States are identify as spiritual but not religious. And so I think the weaving of these two traditions provides a space for people who are either multiple traditions or no tradition or, you know, seekers, to find like concrete spiritual practices, which don't require them necessarily to become, you know, a Buddhist or become a Christian, even though that might be what happens. Or, you know, but, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh would say this all the time when people would come from other traditions to practice with us. He's like, the world doesn't need more Buddhists. We need, you know, and people would say that this mindfulness practice helped them to become better Christians, better Jews, better Hindus. He was like, go back to your roots. Use these practices to communicate more lovingly with your, you know, family members, to choose right livelihood, to benefit your communities. You don't have to become a Buddhist. So it was really on offer, very ecumenically. And so I think that's the spirit also of what of our bringing these two traditions together. It's like at the heart of you know, all wisdom traditions, there is this common place of this mystical wisdom of oneness with the divine, of you know, we are all embodiments of the sacred, of the vast, you know, nature of consciousness. And so now we've been gifted this monastery, which we also need to raise money to pay off some, their property tax exemption status lapsed. So by May 1st, we have to pay some $45,000 in property taxes. So, but it was still a gift to receive the land and the buildings that also need to be renovated, which will be fundraising to do that after. Anyway, but this, the gift of this now is like all these things have been sort of leading us step by step, it feels, as we've been building our kind of common life together, have been building in a way to us being able now to create a space where people can come and practice and learn and become part of creating, you know, a new path that's maybe bigger than both traditions, but has the gifts of these traditions very much, very tangible in the daily practice schedule. And we want to have a summer experience for young people where they can also learn about ecology and garden and practice earth-based nature awareness, connecting with the earth, where, you know, people of marginalized identities can find themselves very much in community and that they can belong there. Where we also want to have hermitages where people can do contemplative practice, more solitary, and then even, you know, retreats, a weekly gathering of practice in person. And we'll, you know, try to also continue to do online. So anyway, this is all our vision that's still unfolding. And this is sometime in the future because the buildings all need quite a bit of renovation to be lived in. But it's a very exciting time of feeling like I really feel Adam and I were brought together because the way we came together was so kind of extraordinary. And everything that has unfolded for us has had this feeling of being guided and being led to do the things that we've done. And so, you know, in both of our lives, Adam worked with homeless youth for 15 years in New York City and spent a lot of time in communities like Yogaville and ashrams in India, and, you know, went to a Episcopal seminary that was very much a monastic structure. So we've had communal living, we've had formation, both of us spiritually, for much of our, you know, adult lives that was really focused on getting spiritually nourished ourselves, doing spiritual transformation inside, and then also supporting others to access that. So I think we both, you know, bring all of the different things that we've been formed by into this new area.
It sounds like a wonderful experience. And I really love the idea of creating a space for spiritual practices that doesn't have requirements for people, that they can just become better people, or like you said, better Catholics or better Jews or better Hindus or whatever it is, if they choose to stay with their tradition. And I really love that idea. And it seems to me like you've been given this vision, you know, you've been brought together and you've been given this vision, and this $45,000 tax thing is an unfortunate thing, but it's like the vision is there. So it's clear that somehow the universe is going to come together to make all of this happen for you all so you can continue in this really good community work. So it'll be interesting to see how all that comes together. I'd be interested in pivoting a little bit now towards your most recent book, The Healing Our Way Home. And with you and Valerie and Maricela, it's an interesting book. It seems like you guys are just like in conversation, like the three of you are sitting around a table and talking. And I don't know how it all came together, but you each have a voice in the book. And it's not like you each have a chapter. It's like each chapter, you each have something to contribute to that topic. And it's a really interesting way to convey a message that has a commonality to it, but also a lot of diversity. And so it's a very, very interesting read. Can you share a little bit about that experience and what you all are trying to accomplish?
Sure. So it was really a beautiful experience of coming together to have very intimate conversations between friends. I like to use the image of, you know, the kitchen, the kitchen table, where the deeper, more personal stories can come out. And so it was Valerie's idea. She gathered us about 2018. We all met at a conference. She said, you know, we need to write a book about our experience as Black women on this spiritual path. And so we said, okay. And so we said, why don't we just start recording our conversations and then we can transcribe them into chapters. And so that's what we did. And we just have started very organically. The first conversation was, you know, what kind of questions do we want to hear each other talk about? And so it had to do with our, you know, it's like the questions you've been asking me, like, what are your early, you know, imprints? What shaped you? Who are your people? How did you get on the spiritual path? You know, what has been, you know, your journey with sexuality, with relationships? How does that figure into the spiritual path? How have you dealt with racism and oppression and internalized oppression? And, you know, as someone, you know, who's received a certain message being Black, or in my case, biracial Black. So we just started with our own curiosity about each other. And so each call was a conversation where one person would share something and that would spark something in someone else. There were so many things that came out in those conversations that I hadn't really shared before and that I don't think would have come up if it hadn't been for what the two of them shared. And so it was really a collective unfolding where one person watered something and then something sprouted in the other person and that story came out and then that triggered that other story to come out from the other person. So it was just a beautiful kind of weaving and evoking from each other these different life experiences and reflections. And even for me too, I know, because I started, you know, I shared things about my family. I went back to talk to my mom and my dad, my sister. I was like, is this how you remember it? Is this accurate? I don't want to be, you know, getting it wrong. And we had amazing conversations that really shaped some of my shares in the book, where it went much deeper because of what my parents or my sister shared with me, that I could sort of round out just be more true to, you know, what I had experienced, say, as a child. I wouldn't have known some of the nuances. And so that was really beautiful too, to get to really reflect on my story with my family and have their voices somehow in there as well. But really it was, you know, our purpose in doing this book was to help people who might not see themselves reflected on this spiritual path to really feel that they could belong as well, that anybody basically could walk this path if they were interested in it, that you don't have to be of a certain demographic, of a certain class, of a certain educational level, you know, of a certain gender or sexual orientation. So it was just really trying to open the doors wider by telling our stories, you know, because if you look at a lot of the teachers or people who have transmitted the teachings of mindfulness in the U.S., or in the West, it's, you know, at least until maybe 10 years ago, it was pretty homogeneous, pretty white, pretty middle class, pretty, you know, upper, you know, educated, highly educated. So I think we wanted to just offer our stories so that people could find themselves in our stories and see that they could have the same kind of experiences of liberation, of transformation that we have touched through these practices. And also to really, you know, the book is for everyone, even as we really ground ourselves in our Black experience and biracial for my case. But Maricela is also Afro-Latina, so she brings that. And Valerie's Caribbean roots, so she brings that perspective too. But even though we're speaking from these specific experiences, I think the book really is for everyone, in the sense that the practices that we talk about, the life experiences that we've had, all point us to how can we support collective awakening? How can we support collective justice and the uprooting of deeply held harmful beliefs and values that our culture has been built on, that say that only some people are fully human and other people are not? And even if this isn't conscious, it's very much there in the unconscious. And so to address that, and that all of us can have a role in that, in rewriting this story and writing a new story of how our country, how our culture can be, as far as really caring for every single human life, and not just human, but all animal life, all plant life, all life, to really see when you start to look at the ways we've learned to otherize, to see ourselves as separate from each other, that that's at the root of our ecological devastation and climate chaos as well, as we've not seen our interbeing. So I think the book is really for everyone, in that it points to, it helps us cultivate the eyes of interbeing, to see that we, even those who perpetrate harm, just like those who are victims of harm, we are all interconnected and we need to all wake up together. We need to heal together so we're not separate.
Thank you for that. I completely agree with everything you're saying and also about your book. I feel like there's always so much benefit for anyone to immerse themselves in another person's story, another person's experience. We are all connected, but until we can actually listen to another person's experience and kind of get ourselves over into how that must have been for them, we do feel that separation. So I think your book serves that purpose. Also, the three of you in conversation, first of all, it's just so beautiful to just hear you guys in, quote, the kitchen. But also, my life is very different than the three of yours, and your life is different than mine. And we all have different kinds of lives. And the more that we could really understand another person's experience, or at least do our best to see through their lens, that helps us connect at the heart, at that human human experience. And that is what we're being called to do on this planet right now. I think you feel it. I feel it. I think most of our listeners feel it, that we are awakening to this interconnectedness. And as you say, not just human, but also with the natural world and the animals and the plants and the trees. And something is, we're on the edge of something, I feel. And I really appreciate that your message and the message of your co-authors is contributing to that.
Thank you. Yes, it does feel like we're part of a larger conversation, right? Of many, many people that are, I call it massaging the kind of acupressure points in the collective consciousness to help energy flow and to help us all see what's really possible. I think there's so much more that's possible if we can turn inward to access our own potential, to enlarge our own capacities, but then to, you know, in collective spaces to also enlarge our capacities. So much healing can happen.
Yeah. So we're coming up on our hour, and I want to make sure that if there's anything else that you wanted to share that I didn't ask you about, that I can give you a few minutes for that.
I think I would just maybe say a little more about the climate crisis, and that it's so important to see our spiritual paths as including work, our understanding of our interconnectedness with all of life, and that we all can do something to support the human race going in a better direction than we're heading in right now. And that's really, really needed. And everyone is needed, and everyone has something to offer. And it may be, you know, right in your own, you know, small place, small area of influence, but that this spending time with the earth, listening to the earth, coming together with others to really see how have we put ourselves above other species and the earth, and how can we heal that distance, that hierarchy? That's a big part of racial healing. That's a big part of writing all forms of social justice, is really writing our relationship with the planet and with all life and with all the systems of life. So I really see this as a spiritual path, a really important spiritual path. And maybe I'll just put in a plug for two different courses that are happening online. I'm a teacher in one of them. It's One Earth Sangha's online course called the Ecosattva Training. It's a self-guided eight module. You can do it in any period of time, but it's eight modules that help people learn to be an Ecosattva, which is a great being that takes care of our planet. And there's another online course that the Plum Village monastics are offering called Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet. And it's also an online, maybe a 6-week course. So check that out if you're interested, if you want more community, if you want to have more ideas, more inspiration of how we can do this kind of work for our planet from a spiritually grounded place, so that we don't burn out, so that we stay nourished and joyful, even as we keep having energy, like I described Ty having so much energy even into his 80s and 90s. If we have a deep spiritual practice, we can always come have more energy to offer and to relieve suffering in us and around us. And I'll also just say, please stay in touch with me. My website is kairajewel.com, KairaJewel.com. And I do a lot of retreats online and events and in person. So we'd be happy for folks to stay in touch.
Great. Thank you, Kaira. And we can have all those links on the show notes as well. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your very interesting story and the work that you're up to now. I think we are all in this together. And I appreciate that the contribution that you're making to our collective awakening. So thank you. And I also want to thank all my listeners. And I now close the Spiritual Forum. Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, you can let me know by leaving a positive rating and review on your favorite podcast app or make a tax-deductible donation at thespiritualforum.org. The Spiritual Forum is a podcast, prayer, and retreat ministry affiliated with Unity Worldwide Ministries. Thank you again for being a part of the Spiritual Forum community. And remember, you are an amazing, divine, and powerful being.